This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
I just can tell you, I go back to Washington in 2 weeks in the lame duck session. And actually, compared to what it'll be next year, lame duck is probably going to look good by comparison.
That's Congressman Barney Frank's assessment of the changing landscape in Washington, D.C. after this week's big Republican gains in the U.S. House of Representatives. But here in Massachusetts, it's as if we were a different country, almost nothing but blue. Democratic Governor Deval Patrick and Democratic Congressman Barney Frank were reelected, of course, and all of our other congressional seats stayed Democratic, too. Still, with the state facing a huge budget deficit, how long will it be before the governor's victory turns bittersweet? That's just one of the week's big stories that we'll be discussing with Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Hi, Peter. Peter, do we have you?
Yeah, do you have me?
Oh, we do. Good. Hi there.
Okay.
And also with us is Julie Mahegan, deputy editorial page editor of the Boston Herald. Julie, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, Julie. Thanks to both of you. And listeners, we're taking calls. We want to know what you think about any and all news from the week. If you're happy with Governor Patrick's pick for the top judge in the state, how you think Governor Patrick is going to deal with an estimated $2 billion budget for shortfall in the state. We want to know what you think about the Democrats' near sweep in Massachusetts, what you thought of Barney Frank's stinging victory speech, and we also want to know what do you think is the future of Republican Party in Massachusetts. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Julie and Peter, before we talk about any politics, let's talk for a little bit about this story that broke overnight about the arrest of these 34 undocumented Brazilians. These were the Brazilians connected to a flight school in Stowe, the town west of Concord. And as I understand it, these were mostly flight students learning to fly who were arrested and also the school's owner. Now, Peter and Julie, either one of you jump in first, but this has to do with terrorism concerns, although no link to terrorism has been found. Is that right?
Yes, Peter? I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right. But I have to say it's a worrying situation because you can't I can't imagine that anyone running a flight school today in the post 9/11 world wouldn't be aware that there's tremendous concern about illegal immigrants seeking to learn how to fly planes, and the idea that this would pass by sort of unnoticed, certainly by the owners, is very, very troubling. And I'm waiting to see how the reporting develops on this.
Although, Peter Kanellis, is it more than just that it passed by unnoticed by the owners? But I thought that these Brazilians actually had U.S. government clearance to train as pilots. So I'm wondering if this is an issue of one government agency not talking to another.
It could be. And I wasn't aware of the U.S. government clearance or what that entails. And I assume that the enforcement may have been at the level of the owner of the flight school, but if so, that's worrying on a whole other level. But I'm very curious to see how this will develop, as I said.
And Julie Mahegan, what's your take on this in terms of, as I understand it, anti-terrorism rules say no illegal immigrants can take flight lessons in this country, but that's exactly what was happening in Stowe.
Right, and I got the sense from reading the coverage of it that perhaps it was a case, and as Peter says, there's still a lot we don't know about this, but it may have been the case that these students had applied and received TSA clearance before ever landing, before stepping foot in the United States, and that maybe when, because I think the owner of the flight school had said that, they all did have TSA clearance. So I think it might be a matter of after they got here, maybe they, maybe they overstayed a visa, maybe there were other immigration violations. So I think that, like Peter said, there's still a lot we don't know. There's more reporting to be done on this, but obviously it's a huge concern. My first thought when I heard about it was that it was a test. Like, a lot of people had run these tests after 9/11 carrying contraband on airplanes and things that might look like bombs and things like that. But then, obviously, it became even a bigger concern when you discovered, no, in fact, this is a loophole, and it brought back a lot of bad memories.
So you thought it may have been, let's plant some illegals training and taking flight lessons, and maybe we'll see if the government system catches them? Is that what you think
it
might be?
I wondered about that, just because we've seen that kind of thing happen in post 9/11 with a lot of the airline security issues. But it sounds to me as if maybe it's not that in fact, it may just be a matter of them having stepped through a loophole.
Now, as we said, so far no links to terrorism have been found. I think that's been confirmed. And Peter Canellis, you referenced this. As you said, it's worrying, and clearly given the flight and flight school connection to September 11th, no one wants to be naive. But I wonder if the two of you feel that this was an overreaction in any way.
I don't. I mean, I think it's a very, very serious point of vulnerability. And the fact that the government eventually caught up to them is probably a comforting sign. But there has to be very close monitoring.
Sure. Julie Mahegan, overreaction in your view?
No, okay. Not at all. I think, unfortunately, what ends up happening in situations like this is where, some people who may not have in any way come close to plotting terrorism or having been involved in any kind of terrorist activity, there's an appearance issue, and they get caught up in all of that. But, that's what happens when, as the government alleges, you violate the immigration laws.
All right, so let's move on to politics, since this was such a big political week. Governor Deval Patrick was reelected, obviously. That means he'll be the governor that has to deal with what's projected to be up to a $2 billion budget deficit. And here's Governor Patrick telling our own WBUR's Bob Oakes about his priorities in his second term.
Well, number one is continuing to expand our opportunities, getting people back to work. And that's the strategy that's been based on education, innovation, and infrastructure. It's a working strategy. It's why we're adding jobs faster than 46 other states. We want to keep that going. I think the biggest legislative push is going to be around payment reform, which is the strategy to get the cost of health care down. And that'll start in January.
All right. So we heard him talk about expanding job creation, reducing health care costs through payment reform, obviously worthy and necessary goals. But I wonder, Julie Mahegan and Peter Canellis, if you consider those goals less ambitious than the ones that Deval Patrick came into office with 4 years ago.
Well, I don't think there's any question that he can't be as ambitious as he was when he came into office 4 years ago. The resources just aren't there. And I think in some ways it was that sort of overly ambitious agenda of, 1,000 new cops on the street and cutting property taxes that came back to bite him in some ways, at least during the campaign, it's not surprising to me that he might sort of step back a little bit, at least in terms of things that cost a lot of money. I mean, the payment reform thing is a huge challenge, and if they're able to produce something that's actually works, will be a huge legislative accomplishment. But it's one of those things that the public isn't necessarily going to glom onto.
Oh, that's interesting. Arguably, as you've said, maybe payment reform is as ambitious as several of the goals he had coming into his first term.
Oh, it is, and perhaps even more ambitious in some ways, because it is just this. It's this behemoth of a system that chews up so much of the budgets at every level, the federal, the state, the local level, and the private, the household level. So I think it is enormously ambitious, and I'm not sure what they'll be able to get done, but it'll be fun to watch.
And Peter Canellis, what did you think of these goals?
Yeah, I agree with what you've been saying, especially about the potentially big changes in the way that hospitals are reimbursed. But I also would add to that, his commitment to maintaining the pace of education reform and to promoting a clean energy future, but not only a clean energy future, but a clean energy industry in Massachusetts, are also, pretty big long-term things that he's going to continue to be pursuing. So, because the budget situation is the way it is, it's not going to be a time for big spending programs, but I think that he does have a clear sense of priorities.
The other thing I would just say is that let's not also underestimate how much of a challenge just balancing the budget is going to be. At this point, they're still talking about a $2 billion budget deficit. As much as the governor hasn't wanted to be specific and has sort of been very optimistic and hopeful that deficit will shrink, we don't know if that's going to happen. And at this point, he's talking about balancing it basically on sort of wishes and rainbows and the rainy day fund.
So that's a big job in itself.
Yeah.
We have a caller who wants to talk a bit about the election and particularly the Democratic sweep. And this is Laura calling from Leominster. And Laura, what did you think about Tuesday's election?
Hi, yeah. Like I said, I've just been beaming with pride since the other day, just absolutely overflowing with pride of Massachusetts. And I've been telling everyone who will listen that we are the little blue state that could.
So what do you think about the fact that we're one of the only little blue states that seem to be left out there? Did you think that us being out of step with the rest of the country does that affect us at all?
To me, it feels like the rest of the country is more out of step with reality, and that's a big concern for me, that we just don't seem to evolve and understand and educate ourselves on what happened over the last 8 years, what it took to get us to where we were, and why people expected it to be fixed in a year.
Laura, thank you for that. And Peter and Julie, before I have you weigh in, I want to bring in another caller with an opposite view, and this is Andrea from Marlboro. And Andrea, what did you think about Tuesday's election?
Well, I have the exact opposite viewpoint of your previous caller. I think that the majority of articles you saw written, the majority of local news stations covering things, we wanted change. And for some reason, I couldn't be more disappointed in the fact that there was a Democratic sweep, that there was not a vehement change. I'm tired of hearing about the unemployment rate, being balanced in this regime, because at the end of the day, people are just getting jobs. They're not getting career-led jobs. They're getting things that will pay some bills, but not all the bills. That's not a solution. That's not fixing the unemployment problem. We do have the budget that your guest talked about. We don't have any solutions. I loved what she said about rainbows and dreams, because we haven't heard anything concrete, and that's not voting for change.
Andrea, thanks for that. So, Julie and Peter, we have two very opposite views there. What did the two of you respond to those callers, in what way?
Well, I would respond in different ways. I think there's some truth and merit in both of those viewpoints. I do think that people in Massachusetts were, curious about change, looking for the possibility for change. The way the races lined up, I don't think the Republicans had strong candidates where they could have won. And in places where they did have strong candidates, I think the Democrats made a better case and a better presentation. And that's why we had the result that we had. As to the person saying that the jobs, we aren't getting careers, we're just getting jobs, I'm sure that's true for a lot of people. But I do think that the policies that kind of won the day in the governor's race are aimed towards, higher paying jobs that do have a future, that do have a career associated with it. And I think that's one reason why places like Massachusetts, California, and New York continued to, vote liberal, Democratic sweeps. You would never believe there was any problem in those states. The place where the biggest change occurred, just like there was in 2008, were those swing states. So you saw huge Republican gains in Pennsylvania, huge Republican gains in Ohio, Florida to a lesser extent. These are places that sort of recognize that they're on the wrong side of the knowledge economy, and there's a lot of frustration. And in 2008, it led them to vote for change in the form of Democrats. Now they're voting for change in the form of Republicans. It's more a structural problem in those states. And I think Governor Patrick made a good case for why we're not in as bad a shape as those states, and people recognized it.
Now, Peter, you just referenced jobs, and Julie Mahegan, coming off that, I wonder whether you think in terms of casinos the governor may try again, since that is a potential job creator.
I never got the feeling that his heart was 100% in it. I mean, from the beginning, he said yes, he would be supportive of casinos. He filed a casino bill. He worked with the legislature to try to get something done. But I never really got the sense that when it didn't happen, that he was heartbroken over it. So I'm not sure whether he'll make that. He's been given ample opportunity to say that's part of his agenda for the next term, and he hasn't said that. He hasn't said anything about trying to balance the budget with revenue from gaming or casinos. So I don't doubt that the legislature will probably take it up again, but I'm just not sure that he'll be the one driving the bus.
Listeners, we're talking about the news of the week. We'll be talking about Barney Frank. We'll be talking about the future of the Massachusetts Republican Party. Give us a call to talk about any or all news of the week at 1-800-423-8255. Again, it's 1-800-423-TALK. And Peter Kanellis and Julie Mahegan, I want to bring in a caller from Waltham who wants to talk about one of the ballot initiatives. This is Sarah from Waltham. And Sarah, what is your thought about Tuesday's election day?
I was really surprised with the fact that we in Massachusetts voted to keep the tax levels the way they are and to help subsidies for housing, but we voted to decrease or to eliminate the alcohol tax, which to me, I was just flabbergasted, because here we are struggling with the high cost of health insurance, and the money from the alcohol tax was to help people suffering from alcohol, which you know, does affect our bottom line for the healthcare coverage.
Sarah, thanks for that. And, you know, I think many people were puzzled the way you were. And I wonder, Peter Canellis and Julie Mahigan, how you make sense of that. Why did voters decide we're going to not roll back the sales tax in general, but we will roll back the sales tax on alcohol?
Well, I would just say that I think that, and I wrote this in the Herald on the editorial page, that had question three rolled back the sales tax to 5%, I firmly believe that it would have passed. I think that people felt that going down to 3%, they bought the argument.
But why alcohol, Julie?
But,
why?
Well, and my other point being that I think, well, first of all, there was an enormous amount of lobbying done by the industry on that side, and I'll acknowledge that. But the other point that we tried to make throughout the campaign and on our editorial page was that, you know, I think people don't like the idea that a product that they buy is taxed twice, which alcohol is. In Massachusetts, there's an excise tax paid at the wholesale level that is built right into the shelf price, and then there's a sales tax. And this thing wasn't around. I mean, it was only on the books for a year. So I think maybe some people thought, well, wait, how did they fund all of those substance abuse treatment programs before this happened? Mm.
You know, Peter Canellis, another argument from the people who wanted the sales tax on alcohol repealed was that alcohol stores tend to be some of the last mom-and-pop businesses around, and we can't hurt them more in a bad economy. Do you think that resonated with people?
I think a little bit. I mean, I think there was, just because there was a little bit of an issue there, especially along the New Hampshire border. But I also think that it's not surprising to me because the vast majority of people buy alcohol at some point. You know, it's not like cigarettes. You know, the smokers are now kind of a discrete minority, and the majority can happily impose taxes on them. But this is something that actually touched everybody in a fairly concrete, tangible way. So it was a narrow margin, but I'm not surprised.
I'd also be, just to interject one more thing, I'd also be interested, I haven't had a chance to crunch all the numbers, but I'd be interested to see what the margins were, as Peter said, sort of up in the Merrimack Valley and in all those communities that have actually been directly affected by an increase in the alcohol sales tax.
I want to bring up Barney Frank, too, of course. In his victory speech, he was characteristically outspoken. He took particular aim at the Boston Herald, which had endorsed his opponent, Sean Bealot. Here's part of what Barney said.
People will advise me sometimes to be more judicious, and sometimes I will be. But with the election of all 10 Democratic congressmen, it appears, and Governor Patrick, one of the things we can acknowledge tonight is that Massachusetts has reaffirmed the complete political irrelevance of the Boston Herald.
Now, Julie Mahigan of the Boston Herald, this is your newspaper he's talking about. What was your reaction when you heard that?
Well, I think my jaw dropped first, and then I laughed. And I thought it was just, I mean, we were just sort of, could he have gift-wrapped this any more for us over here? You know, it's just Barney being Barney in his normal, typical way. And it's funny because I think a lot of people sort of saw Barney a little bit differently during this campaign and thought maybe he had, you know, he had a little bit of a scare put into him, and maybe he was, you know, my colleague Marjorie Egan joked that at one point she called him about something and she knew he was running for re-election because he was nice to her. But, you know, election night made it very clear that the old Barney is back. And, you know, the thing I would say is that Barney Frank is well known for feeling he is intellectually superior not only to any reporter who might deign to ask him a question, but to many of his constituents. And, you know, he thought he was above any form of critical coverage, and he told everybody in the room that that's what he believed. And so it's a blast.
Peter Canellis, before I have you weigh in, I want to go to a caller from South Boston who has a comment, and this is Mary Ellen. And Mary Ellen, what did you think when you heard Barney Frank's comments?
Hi, Sasha. I was delighted. I was laughing out loud at his directness.
Laughing out loud, you said? I'm sorry, you're a little faint. Did you say laughing out loud at his directness and honesty?
Yes, I did, yes. When he said many of the campaigns were not worthy of a democracy, he was absolutely right.
If I could just jump in for a second.
This is Julie Mahigan jumping in.
The one thing I would say is that, you know, I don't think anyone would say that Sean Bealot ran a sort of right-wing propaganda campaign. The guy ran a very clean campaign. He's a very clean candidate. And the notion that, you know, just because Barney had a credible opponent means that, you know, he was a victim of some right-wing machine is just, it's funny to me.
Now, Peter Canales.
Well, but wait.
Sure, go ahead.
Sean Bielitz's slogan was, no individual is more personally responsible for the economic crisis or the economic debacle or something that's struck this country than Barney Frank. That has to bother him a little bit. So I mean, it wasn't a dirty personal attack or anything
exactly.
like that. But as far as like a mainstream policy attack goes, you know, you could not accuse somebody of something more monstrous than destroying the entire U.S. economy. So I'm sure that, you know, Barney did feel a lot of pressure. It was not a gracious speech by any stretch of the imagination. The one thing I would add is that the Herald coverage in the last few days went sort of over the line towards predicting a defeat. There was a piece on the front page talking about how Brookline was going to turn on Barney Frank, and he won it by a 3-1 margin. So that was sort of what was behind kind of his chortling and saying the Herald's out of touch. They didn't, you know, they said I was going to lose Brookline, and I won it by 3-1 margin.
And then Julie Mahegan, of course, in the past few days, the Herald really seems to have gone on the counterattack. You had an op-ed co-authored by your publisher. You had an editorial cartoon. Marjorie Egan wrote a tough column about Barney Frank. Today, a reporter story called Frank a fading Capitol Hill power broker. Was this Herald payback?
Did you expect us to react in any other way? He called us out. We called him back. What are you going to do?
Peter, is this the Herald being the Herald?
I think it's the Herald being the Herald. And, you know, I don't like to see other news organizations attacked, frankly. I wish Barney had been a little bit more gracious, frankly.
My issue is even, I mean, beyond the issue with the Herald, which I, you know, look, we're big grown-ups. We can take it. My other issue is the lack of graciousness in every respect. I mean, I've never seen a winning candidate call out the losing candidate in the way that Barney Frank did, and so, you know, he's...
Well, I don't know about that, but I did think that that across the board, not just in Massachusetts, but across the board, candidates were very, very ungracious. I mean, the winners barely acknowledged the losers nationally. There were a few exceptions, and a lot of the losers were very bitter and you know, condemning of the people who'd won. I mean, there was a lack of positive spirit throughout this election, and I hope it doesn't carry into the new Congress.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say everybody's glad this election is over.
Peter and Julie, we have a caller from Arlington who has another comment about Barney Frank, and Peter, this stems off something you said. So Larry, you're calling from Arlington. What is your thought about Barney Frank?
So it's more a question. Take the acrimonious noise out of this, but let's talk factually. If Barney is so smart, and he was in charge of financial services, and even said that Fannie Mae and Ginnie Mae were financially sound, why didn't more people feel strongly against him going back to Washington? He may not be the only person who's responsible, but he certainly sat in the catbird seat.
Well, here's the thing. I think he sat in the catbird seat, but he had only been in the catbird seat for about a year and a half before the major meltdown occurred. I also think that when it came to Fannie and Freddie legislation and all, I mean, it's a bit of a complicated story where these things go down. But he certainly wasn't the only one who believed that they would be solvent. You had Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, you know, literally as the government was taking over Fannie and Freddie, claiming that they were basically solvent. So it's a bit of a muddy picture. And I think that people felt that where Frank had only been the chairman for a year and a half beforehand, to sort of blame the whole debacle on him and to suggest that he uniquely played a damaging role was a little tough.
In the time we have left, let's do our Friday hubbub. The two of you have done this before. I just want to hear your thought on the one piece of news or information that we may not have mentioned that that is sort of in your mind. And Julie, let's start with you. What was your hubbub from this week?
Well, the story that I liked is that out in Sutton, Massachusetts, there's a new state representative. We didn't get to talk a lot about the gains that the Republicans made in the House of Representatives, but we have Representative Ryan Fatman, the Republican representative-elect from Sutton. And, you know, he got a lot of coverage during this campaign because his signs got stolen, but I don't think there was any lack of publicity about his name, which I think helped to raise his profile out in that district. And, you know, he knocked off a Democratic incumbent, and I just thought it was a fun story. The kid's 24 years old. He'll be going to Beacon Hill in January, and, you know, people will have a lot of fun with it, I'm sure.
And Peter Canellis, your hubbub of the week?
The city of Methuen is reclaiming its history for a native son, or refinding its native son of Robert Frost, the poet who's very much associated with snowy woods and northern New England and everything, actually spent much of his time, his formative years, in Methuen and Lawrence. And, you know, that's sort of a lesson about kind of where art comes from, and that, you know, you may associate himself with him with the woods, but, you know, he had a real life in a very gritty and very different place before then.
My hubbub is a sports hubbub, and I just want to mention, of course, that David Ortiz is back for one more year. It's a pretty lucrative year for him, $12.5 million. What was interesting to me about this is the Red Sox would have preferred not to pay that much money, but they also really only wanted to keep him for a year, not more. So Ortiz would have preferred a longer, more time. Red Sox would have preferred less money, but they were able to get both. And apparently, according to the Globe, Peter, Epstein said that Ortiz's words were he was cool with it. He was cool with $12.5 million, which is a pretty casual way to talk about some pretty big money.
I'd be cool with that.
Thanks to both of you. Peter Canellis is editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, and Julie Mahegan is deputy editorial page editor of the Boston Herald. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
When we come back, is the Boston Police Department pursuing an un-American policy? At least one of you thinks so. We read through your comments from this week's shows. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.